to blow steam. I just left home fast. I'm past curfew by my lonesome. The headphones blast. And
got me in the physical rage. Walking through the dark path of this invisible maze.
But living these past days reckless, I'm thinking of hitting the backspace. I grind your bones to the grains of sand. Able hands, your elementary flow be sticking it to layman's ass. I break more legs than a stable has. Hate to brag when you make a rap, those more mistakes made than replacement refs. Lyrical nightmare with cynical type flair, a venomous bite here that might even put a conditional price tag. I struggle with thoughts, rebuttal with art. The muzzle comes off, a puzzle gets solved. Stunning with songs wandering off through the back rows, my path chose. Daily living is mainly giving me class notes. Recall when days was abusive, pain was seducing me right into a state of confusion. Wish the phase was elusive. These lampposts each lit as I walk by. In reality, I plan to grip like I'm wall climbing.
Get your hoods up, you motherfuckers. Welcome back to Black Hoodie Alchemy. I'm your host, as always, Anthony Tyler. I appreciate you joining me. Don't forget, you can find in the show description links to whatever other action I got. You can check out my books, Dive Manual, Empirical Investigations of Mysticism, or Hunt Manual, 21st Century Demonology and Fortiana. All very Jungian, mystical, rabbit hole dives. And check in the show description. At the time of recording this, I'm still figuring out some of the particulars, but by the time this is released, those particulars will be hashed out. So go to that show description and check out the Patreon action that I have coming soon with collaborator Mr. Seed Person One. Very excited about it. We're going to get a bit more personal, and the both of us are going to hash out the concept of existential alchemy in practice. So, you know, anything and everything, you know, we'll get into dream analysis. I know Seed Persons mentioned some crazy UFO encounters that he'd like help just contextualizing in his own personal life. And so he brought up talking that out a little bit. So, you know, the topic at hand for the Patreon sections is going to be existential alchemy in practice. And we're very excited about that. Seed Person's very cool. He's a diehard listener that's checked out every episode, has a lot of great things to say. Black Hoodie Alchemy also has a Discord chat now. So check the show notes. You can look into that and contribute to the, you know, the conversation in between the episodes. And we already got some really cool people in on the mix, having a good time in there. So get up on it. If you want to support the show, I'm not in this for the money, but damn it, it helps. So, I mean, firstly, you know, I encourage you to go get the books, you know, check out this Patreon action and just, you know, review the show, share it around. Some of the trials and tribulations of figuring out one's own path in the material world is something that has inspired me to bring up the content of C.S. Lewis here. Before I talk about C.S. Lewis and his work, The Problem of Pain, I wanted to expound upon my thoughts a little more. Listeners of this show will be familiar with the fact that I have expressed frustration, existential frustration at, you know, I think I spent so much time as a necessity, as I really needed to. I was off on not the best footing early on. For the last decade or so, you know, I'm 28 now, I've been in diligent study of existentialism, philosophy, esoterica, all these things. I eat, sleep, and breathe it. And I always sort of had an inkling that one of my greatest hurdles, after recorrecting some of the issues I had in my youth, in the long run, it was going to be the material. because I always put so much more emphasis on the spiritual than the material, which I think is best. You know, if you're going to go with one, go with the spiritual, but it's the balance. And I am radically trying to adjust the balance here because some things have really smacked me upside the head lately. And, you know, this morning I woke up from a dream where, you know, I recently went back to Alaska, to Anchorage, where I'm from. I was thankful. I was able to be all on a budget. You know, I know plenty of people there. I got family that are just about to move from there. And it was great. It was very nostalgic. And in that way, it was also somber. And in a lot of ways, I wish that I just enjoyed the dark and cold more, because I would thoroughly enjoy living in Alaska and just staying there. I enjoy the culture. I enjoy everything about it, except how long the fucking dark and cold is. It can get really brutal. It always gets really brutal at one point or another, and it's just so inhospitable. So I to find a place that, you know, suited my physical and mental health the best, I had to leave, but I really wish I didn't have to. And this dream that I mentioned, I have this dream where I'm in Florida now, and Alaska and Florida are like next door to each other. And I lose my job in Florida. I get a new job in Alaska. I lose my job in Alaska. I have to go back to Florida, and I keep ponging back and forth constantly. And it was a very stressful dream, and it's definitely metaphorically indicative of my situation here. I feel very capable, ready, willing, and able as a still young man, but shit's tough out there. So thankfully, I do have a new job. It doesn't pay a tremendous amount, but it's not nearly as much of a hassle as some of the last jobs I've had. It seems like a very good middle ground job, and it will definitely afford me, you know, bill paying and the opportunity to continue to spend time with friends and family and do this podcast. And that's a great start, because the last couple of jobs were really limiting all that, just because unsuitable conditions. And I'm not one to complain either. So I'm trying to figure out my own path here, as we all are. And this got me thinking about C.S. Lewis and his work, The Problem of Pain. C.S. Lewis is by far my favorite Christian author. And maybe, you know, maybe Tolkien had definitely more of an impact, but in terms of, you know, fiction doesn't really win me over, not so much these days, as much as I enjoy it. And I've never read any actual philosophy of Tolkien. I bet it's out there, but I read more of Tolkien's fictional work when I was younger, and I read more of C.S. Lewis's philosophical work, you know, his theological philosophy. He wrote a lot of that. And I would argue, I don't know the exact numbers, but I believe he wrote more philosophy than he did fiction, if not an equal amount. And I'm not a Christian, so if you've stumbled onto this and you're still listening and you're a devout Christian looking for a devout Christian interpretation of The Problem of Pain, I'm sorry to disappoint. I don't think you will be insulted by this show, but this is going to be a broader approach. And for context, a lot of the I consider this a companion piece to my episode, C.G. Jung's Answer to Job, his analysis of the Book of Job. In that episode, I was actually reading from a paperback book. I have a digital copy here with my notes. So recording in that episode, it still sounds perfectly clear, but it doesn't sound quite up to my standards. It's one of my most popular episodes, so it doesn't bother anybody but me. But you'll notice I sound a little further away from the mic, and I compress that all out, so it just doesn't sound as smooth and buttery. Smooth. Anyway, that's just me nitpicking. Go check out that episode. You would have not even hardly noticed a difference if I hadn't brought it up. Couple points before moving forward. Since we're coming at this with a little bit of a Jungian interpretation, I wanted to bring up again the idea that Jung proposes. It's not his original idea. It's an old alchemical motif. The idea of Yahweh as the antinomy, meaning the totality of opposites, good and bad. by being the totality of opposites, we're no longer just good or evil. It's something that I'm not expecting you to wrap your head around right here. I haven't even fully wrapped my head around it. I don't think Jung did. I think from a human perspective, it's naturally a mind fuck, but that's, you know, the essence of God, even as an archetype or a mythological entity. But beyond that, beyond Yahweh as the antinomy, there exists a reflection process that we can see throughout biblical works, and especially in the book of Job. If you're not reading from the force-fed Christian interpretation, it very much appears that Yahweh is going through, for lack of a better term, an enlightenment process, just like Job is going through a similar process by interacting with Yahweh. It's a two-way street. And a great deal of Yahweh's ignorance, for lack of a better term, comes from the fact that in order to come into interaction with aspects of himself, Yahweh, he needs points to focus on and gauge. I mean, that's how any sort of consciousness works. And this idea of Yahweh's ignorance, for lack of a better term, has to do with the common theme. Oh, how to put this into words? You know, it's getting very esoteric Buddhist here, where in order to have a consciousness, we have to have this sort of projection effect, because without something, we have nothing to gauge. And, you know, this is, it's hard to put words into, but when you see it in practice, it's very clear. You know, just look at putting human beings into, you know, isolation and having them lose their minds. There has to be something to gauge. And I mean, you could go into extremes of asceticism, monkhood, and things, but even that is really testing the limits by its nature. So the esoteric supposition here is that Yahweh desperately needed the creation of human beings to not lose his mind, for lack of better terms, so that he could come into a greater union with himself. And I think that's, you know, that's obviously pretty blasphemous as far as your average, you know, street corner church is concerned, but I don't think that takes away anything from God, you know, metaphorically or literally. And I've talked about how I think, you know, using the fewest words possible, I guess God in, you know, because I do believe in God, but I don't like to use that term because I think that it doesn't answer very well the questions that I have. And to me, I guess the fewest word definition is God is the manifestation of life itself. And Goddess would be that which everything springs from, you know. So let's not get tied down. There's a lot more we could talk about there, but let's get into C.S. Lewis and keep those things in mind. I love C.S. Lewis. I think he's a brilliant author. He's a very great writer. He's obviously very Christian. So I think that there's some things that, you know, he is very esoteric with his understanding. He brings up the pagan mysteries. He brings up communism and different things and secular humanism. And he doesn't trash these things either. He says, you know, I don't agree with these things, but, you know, even here are some of the things that there are in common. And we'll see some of these things throughout the quotes I have here, this collage summary that I'm going to read and mull over. So, but, you know, whenever he's talking about the church, I think if we just transpose that with the path or something equivalent to that, you know, the wayward path of the initiate on their way. Well, it's not super poetic, but you get what I mean. Like, if we're all following an altruistic path for a higher purpose, like, that's obviously, that's sort of the underlying comparative religious motif. And C.S. Lewis is a guy I respect. He's definitely a guy I would buy a drink for and have a chit-chat with, because he's someone that is steadfast in his beliefs, but is also very interested in your beliefs and is interested in, you know, all sides of the story. He's a genuine scholar, a genuine Christian scholar. they are unfortunately few and far between. Shout out to my friend Hunter, a longtime listener of the show, known each other since like kindergarten. He very much reminds me of C.S. Lewis in that way. A very good Christian, a scholar in his own right. Not like legitimately, but you know, a diligent student that whose opinion I respect because it's well studied. What the fuck is a scholar anyway? Shit, this is going to be a long episode. I can already feel it. We haven't even started reading yet. Okay, this is the problem of pain. This is the philosophical, theological interpretation that C.S. Lewis proposes, you know, for the context of understanding pain, why it's here, what it does for us, why God gave it to us as an option in the first place. All right, here we go. Let's do this. Many years ago, when I was an atheist, if anyone had asked me, "Why do you not believe in God?" my reply would have been something like this. Look at the universe we live in. By far the greatest part of it consists of empty space, completely dark and unimaginably cold. The bodies which move in this space are so few and so small in comparison with the space itself that even if every one of them were known to be crowded as full as it could hold with perfectly happy creatures, it would still be difficult to believe that life and happiness were more than a byproduct to the power that made the universe. As it is, however, the scientists think it likely that very few of the suns of space, perhaps none of them except our own, have any planets, and in our own system it is improbable that any planet except the Earth sustains life, and Earth herself existed without life for millions of years and may exist for millions more when life has left her. And what is it like while it lasts? It is so arranged that all forms of it can live only by preying upon one another. In the lower forms, this process entails only death, but in the higher, there appears a new quality called consciousness, which enables it to be attended with pain. The creatures cause pain by being born and live by inflicting pain, and in pain, they mostly die. In the most complex of all the creatures, man, remember this was written in like the 1940s or something, so you're not going to get progressive vernacular here. Yet another quality appears, which we call reason, whereby he is enabled to foresee his own pain, which henceforth is preceded with acute mental suffering, and to foresee his own death while keenly desiring permanence. It also enables men by 100 ingenious contrivances to inflict a great deal more pain than they otherwise could have done on one another and on the irrational creatures. This power they have exploited to the full. Their history is largely a record of crime, war, disease, and terror, with just sufficient happiness interposed to give them, while it lasts, an agonized apprehension of losing it, and when losing it, the poignant misery of remembering. Every now and then they improve their condition a little, and what they call a civilization appears. But all civilizations pass away, and even while they remain, inflict peculiar sufferings of their own, probably sufficient to outweigh what alleviations they may have brought to the normal pains of man. That our own civilization has done so, no one will dispute. That it will pass away like all its predecessors is surely probable. Even if it should not, what then? The race is doomed. Every race that comes into being in any part of the universe is doomed, for the universe, they tell us, is running down and will sometime be a uniform infinity of homogeneous matter at a low temperature. All stories will come to nothing. All life will turn out in the end to have been a transitory and senseless contortion upon the idiotic face of infinite matter. If you ask me to believe that this is the work of a benevolent and omnipotent spirit, I reply that all the evidence points in the opposite direction. Either there is no spirit behind the universe, or else the spirit is indifferent to good and evil, or else an evil spirit. I can very much relate to that, not completely, but I really liked how he worded that. And it is interesting that C.S. Lewis was an atheist turned devout Christian. Certainly not the first, certainly not the last. Makes me feel like, just in my personal opinion, people get sold on certain qualities, the, you know, true essence in Christianity, and then they take the other parts wholesale just because it's wrapped up in the bundle. Because a lot of this is beautiful, and I completely agree with. And then there's other stuff that just seems like like he was pigeonholed by the Christian ideology itself. Like there's not even a whole lot of conviction in it. It's just like, well, this is, you know, this is the Christian doctrine and that's that. But no matter how much I can agree with some of the aspects and perhaps even the tone of that opening sentiment, it is certainly too one-sided. It's too cynical and jaded. And this episode, this book, The Problem of Pain, probes just that, a lot of the jaded cynicism that comes from just hardening from all the pain we experience. All right, so onward with my collage of quotes here, all in successive order. Suppose you were told there was a tiger in the next room. You would know that you were in danger and would probably feel fear. But if you were told that there is a ghost in the next room and believed it, you would feel indeed what is often called fear, but of a different kind. It would not be based on the knowledge of danger, for no one is primarily afraid of what a ghost may do to him, but of the mere fact that it is a ghost. It is uncanny rather than dangerous, and the special kind of fear it excites may be called dread. With the uncanny, one has reached the fringes of the numinous, or the mystical. We do not know how far back in human history this feeling goes. The earliest men almost certainly believed in things which would excite the feeling in us if we believed in them, and it seems therefore probable that numinous awe is as old as humanity itself. But our main concern is not with its dates. The important thing is that somehow or other it has come into existence, and it is widespread and does not disappear from the mind with the growth of knowledge and civilization. The absolutely impossible may also be called the intrinsically impossible because it carries its impossibility within itself instead of borrowing it. Speaking further on the numinous or mystical states and God himself, Lewis writes, the absolute impossible may also be called the intrinsically impossible because it carries its impossibility within itself instead of borrowing it from other impossibilities, which in turn depend upon others. It has to, unless it is, it has no unless clause attached to it. It is impossible under all conditions and in all worlds and for all agents. Something intrinsically impossible. All agents here includes God himself. His omnipotence means power to do all that is intrinsically impossible, not to do the intrinsically possible. You may attribute miracles to him, but not nonsense. This is not limit to his power. This is no limit to his power, though. If you choose to say God can give a creature free will and at the same time withhold free will from it, you have not succeeded in saying anything about God. Meaningless combinations of words do not suddenly acquire meaning simply because we prefix to them the two other words, God can. It remains true that all things are possible with God. The intrinsic possibilities are not things, but non-entities. It is no more possible for God than for the weakest of his creatures to carry out both of two mutually exclusive alternatives. Not because his power meets an obstacle, but because nonsense remains nonsense even when we talk about God. Interesting philosophical gymnastics, but I enjoy it. That's the kind of shit I dig right there. Agree with it or not, it's good food for thought, I think. So concerning the nature of matter and free will combined in an interesting argument that's going to play into this problem of pain, I really like this here. We can perhaps conceive of a world in which God corrected the results of this abuse of free will by his creatures at every moment, so that a wooden beam became soft as grass when it was used as a weapon, and the air refused to obey me if I attempted to set it up in sound waves that carry lies or insults. But such a world would be one in which wrong actions were impossible and in which, therefore, freedom of the will would be void. Nay, if the principle were carried out to its logical conclusion, evil thoughts would be impossible, for the cerebral matter which we use in thinking would refuse its task when we attempted to frame them. All matter in the neighborhood of a wicked man would be liable to undergo unpredictable alterations. that God can and does on occasion modify the behavior of matter and produce what we call miracles is part of the Christian faith. But the very conception of a common and therefore stable world demands that these occasions should be extremely rare. Perhaps this is not the best of all possible universes, but the only possible one. Possible worlds can mean only worlds that God could have made but didn't. The idea that which God could have done involves a too anthropomorphic conception of God's freedom. Whatever human freedom means, divine freedom cannot mean intermediacy between alternatives and choice of one of them. Perfect goodness can never debate about the end to be attained, and perfect wisdom cannot debate about the means most suited to achieve it. The freedom of God consists in the fact that no cause other than himself produces his acts, and no external obstacles impede him, that his own goodness is the root from which they all grow, and his own omnipotence the air in which they all flower. The problem of reconciling human suffering with the existence of a God who loves is only insoluble so long as we attach a trivial meaning to the word love and look on things as if man were the center of them. Man is not the center. God does not exist for the sake of man. Man does not exist for his own sake. But God wills our good, and our good is to love him. And to love him, we must know him. And if we know him, we shall in fact fall on our faces. If we do not, that only shows that what we are trying to love is not yet God, though it may be the nearest approximation to God which our thoughts and fantasy can attain. Yet the call is not only to prostration and awe, it is to a reflection of the divine life, a creaturely participation in the divine attributes which is far beyond our present desires. See, this is the positive quality of the rigid Christian God that I think is a great takeaway for everybody. I think this was meant to be the backbone, and there was a lot of bullshit that became strings attached. The idea of a humility, not a humiliation, but a humility and a humbleness, a sense in faith and in powers greater than our own. These are very, very positive human traits, pro-adaptive even human traits that even, an atheist would do well to take into account. You know, at best, God gives us humility and accountability and grace, and shows us through that humility and accountability the thread that connects us all. Some real trouble with pain, he continues, is that kindness is a quality fatally easy to attribute to ourselves on inadequate grounds. Everyone feels benevolent if nothing happens to be annoying to him at the moment. Thus, a man easily comes to console himself for all his other vices by conviction that his heart's in the right place and he wouldn't hurt a fly. Though, in fact, he has never made the slightest sacrifice for a fellow creature. We think we are kind when we are only happy. It is not so easy on the same grounds to imagine oneself temperate, chaste, or humble. When we merely say that we are bad, the wrath of God seems a barbarous doctrine. As soon as we perceive our badness, it appears inevitable, a mere corollary from God's goodness. To keep ever before us the insight derived from such a moment as I have been describing, to learn to detect the same inexcusable corruption under more and more of its complex disguises, is therefore indispensable to the real understanding of the Christian faith. The emotion of shame has been valued not as an emotion, but because of the insight to which it leads. I think that insight should be permanent in each man's mind. But whether the painful emotions that attend it should be also encouraged is a technical problem of spiritual direction on which, as a layman, I have little call to speak. Writers point out that the idea of sin presupposes a law to sin against, and since it would take centuries for the herd instinct to crystallize into custom and for custom to harden into law, the first man, if there ever was a being who could be so described, could not commit the first sin. Not literally. This argument assumes, though, that virtue and herd instinct commonly coincide, and that the first sin was essentially a social sin. But the traditional doctrine points to a sin against God, an act of disobedience. Sort of aside points that I think are worth touching on a little bit. For to understand pain from a Christian perspective, we have to understand sin. And I think that, you know, even though it's got a special flavor in Christian theology, I think sin is not a throwaway concept. I don't think we should consider it, you know, I think that the idea of these end-all be-all points of heaven and hell are very limiting. I don't think that's what, you know, comparative religion actually shows us. I don't think that's even what Christianity actually shows us, to be clear. I think there are more states of existence that are very multifaceted. They're not endpoints. And sin, I think, while not exactly the same, I don't mean to, you know, overgeneralize. Karma and sin are very similar. And I think the idea of unskillful thought leading to pain is a key takeaway. Don't think of it as right and wrong, good and evil, because that is a major Christian fallacy that even C.S. Lewis upholds, and I just couldn't be more against it. Being right and wrong in a factual sense has nothing to do, well, it can be a slippery slope, but at a starting point, has nothing to do with good and evil. And that's where a lot of people's ego gets involved, and that's where we have so much fuckery today. Because if you're wrong, it's an opportunity to improve and learn and you know, become better. You know, whether people look at it this literally or not, I can see it everywhere. Their brains, you know, their consciousness equates the two far too literally. And people are afraid to admit they're wrong because they think there's some sort of injustice or evil in it. And it has everything to do with Christian theology, Abrahamic theology especially, but particularly Christian theology here in the West. And I can't stand it. It's so narcissistic, egotistical, and we need to do away with it. We need to look at things in terms of being skillful and unskillful. It's not a matter of, if I'm wrong, I'm going to hell. That's barbaric. It's obscene, to be quite honest. And I just don't think that it actually holds up when you read the Bible itself.
I'm from where the talk is grim, the autumn wind carrying my thoughts to the darkest ends, a park bench, my sanctuary to crawl in, a marksman whose aim is weary, I'm wobbling, I'm on my humble in this concrete jungle, wax stumbles off the needle when you finally mumble and blindly stumble, I turn to 16 to mince meat, microphones get misty out like they'll miss me, BBC and I, we got insane traits, like two bars from a verse, we on the same page, in the art I'm immersed beyond the blank frame, watch the monster emerge, he about to take names. We on the medium of seasonal change. It's symbolic, kick debris, and y'all ain't seeing the thing. So quit watching each day. You feeling like D-Wade, physically bad and no longer the man to his teammates. I'm in that state of mind when autumn hits, inspiration drives. Consider it my favorite time for the chill of winter's coming about. I'm at home in the year's last loveliest smile. I'm in that state of mind. Autumn bring the grayest skies. The lack of color, it portrays the vibe. Melancholy so barren as the trees. Life imitating art, perishing the weak. Mid-autumn night's breeze colder than the shoulder hit. Bars from the grill heat up like Oktoberfest. Thoughts splash like puddles on a rainy day. The best talents in the underground, that's a saving grace. I spit till I'm hoarse, spill like rivers across your living room floors. You lost and we're missing abroad. The beat's pure, you'll rip it if you screw hard. I give variety and you flip it every two bars. No blue scholar but a true author. Set up a merch booth that shows, hoping that I move product. You get soaked standing under rain too wet. The rap scene, the real Hunger Games movement. When I aim from afar, I don't leave a whack rapper looking like an alcoholic. Wasted at bars, you'll get to raking them all after the truth explodes. Tonight I'm making the bars, into the booth I go. I'm in that state of mind when autumn hits, inspiration drives. Consider it my favorite time for the chill of winter's coming about. I'm at home in the year's last loveliest smile. I'm in that state of mind.
Howdy do, everybody. That's right, it's me, good old Tippy Patson here. And I got some great dang old news, man. With the new year, I am, in fact, going to become the spiritual mentor for NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers. And I tried to reach out through the interwebs, and we got a hold of him. I'm going out to New York, and, you know, dang old man, it just feels good to have a win. It was an interesting year, 2023, but it had some tough times. As you know, we've lost many of our recruits. But don't worry, the League of Extraordinary Gents ain't going nowhere. We're just trying to expand our dang old horizons. And speaking of dang old horizons in the new year, a lot of people doing that old New Year's resolutions and whatnot. Well, don't forget Tippy Patson's Rainbow Body Weight Loss Program, you know, with a month's worth at a time of Colombian cocaine paste called Bazooko. But also, you know, there's a lot of great old tips and tricks. So keep this in mind for your New Year's resolution. If you're, you know, if you're trying to do more cardio, you know, just start smoking more cigarettes. That's what a lot of doctors won't tell you. Okay. But smoking cigarettes, it raises your blood pressure and makes your heart beat fast. So, you know, it's basically the same thing as cardio. Also, you know, yeah, have you ever, like accidentally, you know, cooked like a real hot meal and then put some aluminum foil on it? And noticed that dang old aluminum was melting. You know, a lot of doctors will tell you that ain't no good. But Tippy Patson is here to tell you that some aluminum shavings in your coffee every day will keep the doctor away. You know, it's just as good for you as zinc or iron or all them metals. So, you know, you could do that. It's an ancient Chinese remedy, I do believe. And lastly, just keep in mind, you can't have too much blood. You know, so the serial killer Richard Chase, he was always trying to get blood in him, and he did it in the wrong ways, but he had the right idea, I tell you what, boy. So, you know, just get a bunch of blood and just start putting that inside you. You know, the more virile you are, the more like gasoline, like blood, you know, metaphorically your body will have to work with, and you'll be, you know, all the better for it. You know, these are all the tips I'm going to give Aaron, but, you know, I can't give away all my secrets on the radio. So, you know, just get a little bit in there for now, you know. I hope y'all have a good new year and stick to your dang old resolutions and, you know, put some of my tips into effect. Tippy Patson is out of here for now, folks. We'll keep you updated on my travels. All right, take it easy.
Hello, everybody. It is I, Jefferson Tillamook Slinger, former Illuminati cloning lab manager and current member of the League of Extraordinary Gents. You know, as you've heard, Tippy Patson is going to the Big Apple, so I will be holding down the fort here in the Everglades, and I've been thinking this is probably a very good time for, like, a rebranding type thing, and I've recently sobered up using Bazooko with the Tippy Patson Rainbow Body Weight Loss Program, high five, and, you know, I've been thinking, like, you know, I need to just reinvent myself. I've had a lot of dumb names. I know Tillamook Slinger. But so I got to come up with something sleek. So I was thinking Jeff Mamba. Yeah, Jeff Mamba. Like, because I've been watching a lot of Chris Angel Mind Freak lately. And Jeff Mamba, Chris Angel, kind of have, like, had a similar thing going on. But so I was thinking, like, Jeff Mamba, Mind Master. But, and that might be a good one. But I don't know for sure. You know, I'm clearly going to be a master. So maybe I should be a little more descriptive. Like, I could be like Jeff Mamba, mind jockey. You know, like a horse jockey, except for your mind. Or I could be like Jeff Mamba, mind surfer. Because I surf the waves of your mind. I don't know. Oh, but I think I'm on the right track. If you want to give me some ideas or tell me which one is your favorite, go ahead and contact Joseph Rupert of the Fringe FM's Lighting the Void. I'll give you his personal cell phone number. It's 779-2011-1952-9. Write that down. Okay, Jeff Mamba holding it down in the Everglades for the League of Extraordinary Gents. And I am out of here.
What is up, Protendos? It is I, Muscle Tornado. You know, I've just, you may know me as a super fit DMT numerologist explorationer and, member of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But I've been going through, I've had a lot of casualties lately, and, my hand is gone. I have a hook now. I've lost my hair, I think due to the stress. I lost my eye recently. And unfortunately, recently, I was violently savaged by piranhas in the water, and my leg is gone. So, I have like a thigh nub. But other than that, I'm doing great. I'm doing really good, guys. I haven't really been smoking a lot of DMT lately, but I've been keeping strong with the insufflation of the pixie stick, and it's been a good time, I just started wearing a pirate hat because I figured I should just embrace it right now. I'm not really sure the whole pirate code is, because unfortunately we lost our cosmic ghost pirate because I accidentally changed the channel on him. He was just stuck in the TV, and so the only one that could have really understood my plight, now that I've come to terms with it, is gone. So, but I do have a cool peg leg now. That's pretty sweet. So, we're just going to rock it. I'm going to put a lot of bedazzlements and jewels on it. And, we'll have a good time. So, but yeah, Tippy Patson's leaving. So, it's just going to be me and Jeff Mamba. So. We're gonna see what the future holds, guys. Take it sleazy, and Muscle Tornado is over and out.
Oh yeah, boom, ba ba da.
You see them car brights? You heading for the starlight? You can't hide without blowing your spot. Once the trunk pop, this turncoat going to the top. You see them car brights? Heading for the starlight. We tie loose ends with the holes in your knot. It's origami where you fold in a box. Are you not entertained? Pull up on your block in the range. Chopper aimed empty in pockets and change. Watches and rings, lockets and chains locked in the safes. Drop your wallets and turn to walk the opposite way. Pray that they find you kill. It's not guaranteed you walking around alive and well with survivor's guilt. Sipping wine distilled. These spring chickens scramble they sales but still can't provide a meal. Your guns ablaze when mine's concealed. I bust shots when I suicide dive behind the driver's wheel. There's devotion in the kill. You floating in the whale. This pumps a body of water, you hear the ocean in the shells, and each round is consecutive. When they let my record spin, it stops from exhaustion till it gets a second wind. I let y'all shine, even shoot the breeze, fire hot lead until my polar opposites melt a few degrees. You see them car brights? You heading for the starlight. Can't hide without blowing your spot. Once the trunk pop, this turncoat going to the top. You see them car brights? You heading for the starlight. We tie loose ends with the holes in your knot. It's origami where you fold in a box.
Well, let's continue. Now that we kind of have a deeper consideration of the word sin. For long centuries, God perfected the animal form, which was to become the vehicle of humanity in the image of himself. See, this is... As far as I understand it, centuries is definitely, it's way longer than that. But this was C.S. Lewis understanding the scientific adaptation process. And that's refreshing to me. We see Manly P. Hall talk about very similar concepts, and we see Jung and a lot of others. And I really like this quote here. So for centuries, we've seen God, create humans, the vehicle for humanity. He gave it hands whose thumbs could be applied to each of the fingers, and jaws and teeth and a throat capable of articulation, and a brain sufficiently complex to execute all the material motions whereby rational thought is incarnated. The creature may have existed for ages in this state before it became man. It may even have been clever enough to make things which a modern archaeologist would accept as proof of its humanity. But it was only an animal because all its physical and psychical processes were directed to purely material and natural ends. Then, in the fullness of time, God caused to descend upon this organism, both on its psychology and physiology, a new kind of consciousness, which could say I and me, which could look upon itself as an object which knew God, which could make judgments of truth, beauty, and goodness, and which was so far above time that it could perceive time flowing past it. This new consciousness ruled and illuminated the whole organism, flooding every part of it with light, and was not, like ours, limited to a selection of the movements going on in one part of the organism, namely the brain. Man was all consciousness. Dust thou art, and unto the dust shalt thou return. The total organism, which had been taken up into his spiritual life, was allowed to fall back into the merely natural condition from which, at his making, it had been raised. Just as far earlier in the story of creation, God had raised vegetable life to become the vehicle of animality, and the chemical process to be the vehicle of vegetation, and the physical process to be the vehicle of chemical. Thus, human spirit, from being the master of human nature, became a mere lodger in its own house, or even a prisoner. Rational consciousness became what it is now, a fitful spotlight resting on a small part of the cerebral motions. But this limitation of the spirit's powers was a lesser evil than the corruption of the spirit itself. It had turned from God and become its own idol, so that though it could still turn back to God, it could do so only by painful effort, and its inclination was selfward. The thesis of this chapter is simply that man, as a species, spoiled himself, and that good to us in our present state, and that good to us in our present state must therefore mean primarily remedial or corrective good. What part pain actually plays in such remedy or correction is now to be considered. But how can I say with sufficient tenderness what here needs to be said? It does not matter that I know I must become, in the eyes of every hostile reader, as it were, personally responsible for all this suffering that I try to explain. Just as to this day, everyone talks as if St. Augustine wanted unbaptized infants to go to hell. But it matters enormously if I alienate anyone from the truth. Let me implore the reader to try to believe, if only for a moment, that God, who made these deserving people, may really be right when he thinks that their modest prosperity and the happiness of their children are not enough to make them blessed. That all this must fall from them in the end, and that if they have not learned to know him, they will be wretched. And therefore he troubles them, warning them in advance of an insufficiency that one day they will have to discover. The life to themselves and their family stands between them and the recognition of their need. He makes that life less sweet to them. I call this a divine humility, because it is a poor thing to strike our colors to God when the ship is going down under us, a poor thing to come to him as a last resort, to offer up our own when it is no longer worth keeping. If God were proud, he would hardly have us on such terms, but he is not proud. You would like to know how I behave when I am experiencing this pain, not writing books about it. You need not guess, for I will tell you, I am a great coward. But what is that to the purpose? If I knew any way of escaping pain, I would crawl through the sewers to find it. But what is the good of telling you about my feelings? You know them already. They are the same as yours. I am not arguing that pain is not painful. Pain hurts. This is what the word means. I am only trying to show that the old Christian doctrine of being made perfect through suffering is not incredible. To prove it palatable is beyond my design. But this is kind of call back to my reference, consideration of the esoteric divine humility and grace, the process that I think is the most beautiful aspect of Christianity. And while I don't think it answers everything, it does shed light on a genuine, positive Christian interpretation of, you know, the book of Job. Why would God let Job suffer? And I don't think that Jung's interpretation and Lewis's interpretations are mutually exclusive. I think the only thing that is controversial about Jung's interpretation is that it is in addition to, you know, but they don't really, like, Jung would not disagree with Lewis. Lewis would disagree with Jung. Do you get what I mean? Mr. C.S. Lewis goes a little further and talks about his own pain a little bit without getting melodramatic. My own experience is something like this. I am progressing along the path of life in my ordinary, contentedly fallen and godless condition, absorbed in a merry meeting with my friends for the morrow or a bit of work that tickles my vanity today, a holiday of a new book, when suddenly a stab of abdominal pain that threatens serious disease or a headline in the newspaper that threatens us all with destruction sends this whole pack of cards tumbling down. At first, I am overwhelmed, and all my little happinesses look like broken toys. Then, slowly and reluctantly, bit by bit, I try to bring myself into the frame of mind that I should be in at all times. I remind myself that all these toys were never intended to possess my heart, that my true good is in another world, and my only real treasure is Christ. And perhaps, by God's grace, I succeed, and for a day or two, become a creature consciously dependent on God and drawing its strength from the right sources. But the moment the threat is withdrawn, my whole nature leaps back to the toys. I am even anxious, God forgive me, to banish from my mind the only thing that supported me under the threat, because it is now associated with the misery of those few days. Thus, the terrible necessity of tribulation is only too clear. The necessity for human tribulation and what it does. It has sometimes been asked whether God commands certain things because they are right, or whether certain things are right because God commands them. And I think it's a little bit of both in some cases, if you ask me. I emphatically embrace the first alternative, Lewis says. The second might lead to the abominable conclusion that charity is good only because God arbitrarily commanded it, that he might equally well have commanded us to hate him and one another, that hatred would then have been right. I believe, on the contrary, that they err who only thinks that of the will of God to do this or that. Yeah, I mean, honestly, the way it looks to me is, I think Christianity at its core was meant to be that God commands certain things because they are right. But what it has mostly been, especially, you know, more often than not throughout its history, when involved in politics, it is things are right because God commands them. A familiar example is Abraham's trial when he was ordered to sacrifice Isaac. With the historicity or the morality of that story, I am not now concerned, but with the obvious question, if God is omniscient, he must have known what Abraham would do without any experiment. Why then this needless torture? But as St. Augustine points out, whatever God knew, Abraham at any rate did not know, and he did not know that his obedience could endure such a command until the event taught him. And the obedience which he did not know that he would choose, he cannot be said to have chosen, you know, if it had never happened. The reality of Abraham's obedience was the act itself, and what God knew in knowing that Abraham would obey was Abraham's actual obedience on that mountaintop at that moment. To say that God need not have tried the experiment is to say that because God knows, the thing known by God need not exist. This, especially right here, brings me right back to Jung and his interpretation of the Book of Job. The whole idea that God needs us just as much as we need him in this interpretive two-way street projection process. And in essence, it's the whole idea of ceremony and ritual. You know, you light the candles, you light the incense, you do the things to get you in the zone, the mystical state of mind for prayer and mystical states. And so forth, because those things are all meant to trigger. You know, it's like the kicks in Inception, but backwards. We're going deeper into the dreams with these kicks, with the specific incense and the specific hymns and all these things. Going deeper in a targeted way. You know, fucking being the diver. And sure, I mean, you could do that without those kicks, but how? You know, there needs to be, in the same way of in isolation, a human being goes insane, a part of the whole consciousness experience is having something with which to gauge it. And, you know, I like the point he makes here. Again, morality and historicity of the story aside, I think it's a very good point. From nature, perhaps the oldest agricultural communities learned it, and with animal or human sacrifices showed forth for centuries that here C.S. Lewis talks a little bit about sacrifice in history. From nature, perhaps the oldest agricultural communities learned it, and with animal or human sacrifices showed forth for centuries the truth that without shedding of blood, there is no remission. And though at first such conceptions may have concerned only the crops and offspring of the tribe, they came later in the mysteries to concern the spiritual death and the resurrection of the individual. The Indian ascetic, mortifying his body on a bed of spikes, preaches the same lesson. The Greek philosopher tells us that the life of wisdom is a practice of death. The sensitive and noble heathen of modern times makes his imagined gods die into life. Mr. Huxley, Aldous himself, expounds non-attachment. We cannot escape the doctrine by ceasing to be Christians. It is an eternal gospel revealed to men wherever men have sought or endured the truth. It is the very nerve of redemption which, anatomizing wisdom at all times and in all places, lay bare. Anatomizing. I'm not even sure if that's an actual word, but I like it. It is the very nerve of redemption. Those who most scornfully repudiate Christianity as a mere opiate of the people have a contempt for the rich, that is, for all of mankind except the poor. They regard the poor as the only people worth preserving from liquidation and place in them the only hope of the human race. But this is not compatible with a belief that the effects of poverty on those who suffer it are wholly evil. But this is not compatible with a belief that the effects of poverty on those who suffer it are wholly evil. It even implies that they are good. The Marxist thus finds himself in real agreement with the Christian in those two beliefs which Christianity paradoxically demands, that poverty is blessed and yet ought to be removed. The problem about avoiding our own pain admits a similar solution. Some ascetics have used self-torture. As a layman, I offer no opinion on the prudence of such a regimen, but I insist that whatever it merits, self-torture is quite a different thing from tribulation sent by God. Everyone knows that fasting is a different experience from missing your dinner by accident or through poverty. Fasting asserts the will against the appetite, the reward being self-mastery and the danger pride. Involuntary hunger subjects appetites and will together to the divine will, furnishing an occasion for submission and exposing us to the danger of rebellion. But the redemptive effect of suffering lies chiefly in its tendency to reduce the rebel will. Ascetic practices, which in themselves strengthen the will, are only useful insofar as they enable the will to put its own house in order. The settled happiness and security which we all desire, God withholds from us by the very nature of the world. But joy, pleasure, and merriment he has scattered broadcast. We are never safe, but we have plenty of fun and some ecstasy. It is not hard to see why. The security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world and oppose an obstacle to our return to God. A few moments of happy love, a landscape, a symphony, a merry meeting with our friends, a football match, have no such tendency. Our Father refreshes us on the journey with some pleasant inns, but will not encourage us to mistake them for home. Here, C.S. Lewis gets into hell a little bit. And these are some of the things I feel like he gets very esoteric about some of it, and then just kind of pigeonholes himself because he's relegated to specifically Christian thought, and he's not allowed to step outside the bounds. So there is some good stuff to be said that I'll read through, but a lot of it is just like, okay, fuck it. I've heard this before. Thanks, but no thanks. You know, yawn. I'm fucking, if hell is what you say it is, then I'm already fucking going there. I'm not interested in playing your morality games. You know, I don't just because I'm not a Christian doesn't mean I'm not a good person. And if that means I'm going to hell, then, you know, that's just my act of rebellion. I'm not standing for that shit. And I don't think that's how it works anyway. In all our experience, he says, the destruction of one thing means the emergence of something else. Burn a log and you have gases, heat, and ash. To have been a log means now being those three things. If soul can be destroyed, must there not be a state of having been a human soul? And is not that perhaps the state which is equally well described as torment, destruction, and privation? You will remember that in parable, the saved go to a place prepared for them, and while the damned go to a place never made for them at all. To enter heaven is to become more human than you ever succeeded in being in earth. To enter hell is to be banished from humanity. And I really like the archetypal symbolism of this, at the very least. What is cast into hell is not a man, it is remains. To be a complete man means to have passions obedient to the will and the will offered to God. To have been a man would presumably mean to consist of a will utterly centered in itself and passions utterly controlled by the will. Seems like a very low-key stab at Crowley, and I don't necessarily think it was intentional, but all the talk of will, you can't help but not think of Aleister Crowley. And, you know, I'm in the C.S. Lewis camp here. I'm not going, you know, over-Christianizing the idea of God. As I have talked about many times, look into the trees of life and death. I think, you know, they're going to raise more questions, but I think those have a lot of starting point answers for people that ask me what my thoughts on God are. And they do have to do with manifestation of existence and so forth. I think that humility unto a higher power, not a mythological man in the sky, but humility unto a higher power is a very necessary thing. And I think that people like Crowley miss that. You know, I just think that it's the middle path. You can't. One of a big obvious danger in Christianity is just, you know, throwing yourself into the grinder of the machine, you know, just becoming a statistic in the masses, and sacrificing your individuality for old words that, you know, may have had some spiritual truth, but were interpreted by very old men from a long time ago. I just don't understand why even understanding some sort of divine insight, why people aren't skeptical of the humans who wrote it. It's absurd. So that's that. Let's keep going. Finally, it is objected that the ultimate loss of a single soul means the defeat of omnipotence, and so it does. In creating beings with free will, omnipotence from the outset submits to the possibility of such defeat. But what you call defeat, I call miracle. For to make things which are not itself, and thus to become, in a sense, capable of being resisted by its own handiwork, is the most astonishing and unimaginable of all the feats we attribute to the deity. I willingly believe that the damned are, in one sense, successful rebels to the end. That the doors of hell are locked on the inside. And if you take this not being over-Christianized, this is pretty much exactly what Buddhists believe about the states of hell in the afterlife and how acquiescing the wisdom of the, you know, the pitfalls sort of sends you further in the rebirth process. But you could be stuck there indefinitely. I do not mean that the ghosts may not wish to come out of hell in the vague fashion wherein an envious man wishes to be happy, but they certainly do not will even the first preliminary stages of that self-abandonment through which alone the soul can reach any good. They enjoy forever the horrible freedom they have demanded and are therefore self-enslaved. Just as the blessed, forever submitting to obedience, become through all eternity more and more free. This is what I mean about the esoteric action. The last half of what he's saying here sounds like something I wouldn't even want to disagree with. He just pigeonholes himself sometimes. In the long run, the answer to all those who object the doctrine of hell is itself a question. What are you asking God to do? To wipe out their past sins and at all costs to give them a fresh start? Something every difficulty, smoothing every difficulty and offering every miraculous help? Now he considers heaven. What I'm going to say is merely an opinion of my own without the slightest authority, which I submit to the judgment of better Christians and better scholars than myself. There have been times when I think we do not desire heaven, but more often I find myself wondering whether, in our heart of hearts, we have ever desired anything else. You may have noticed that the books you really love are bound together by a secret thread. You know very well what is the common quality that makes you love them, though you cannot put it into words. But most of your friends do not see it at all, and often wonder why, liking this, you should also like that. Again, you have stood before some landscape which seems to embody what you have been looking at, looking for your whole life, and then turn to a friend at your side who appears to be seeing what you saw, but at the first words, a gulf yawns between you, and you realize that this landscape means something totally different to him, and that he is pursuing an alien vision and cares nothing for the ineffable suggestion by which you are transported. Even in your hobbies, has there not always been some secret attraction which others are curiously ignorant of? Something not to be identified with, but always on the verge of breaking through, the smell of cut wood in the workshop or the clap-clap of water against the boat's side. Are not all lifelong friendships born at that moment when at last you meet another human being who has some inkling, but faint and uncertain, even in the best, of something which you were born desiring, and which, beneath the flux of other desires and in all the momentary silences between the louder passions, night and day, year by year, from childhood to old age, you are looking for, watching for, and listening for? You have never had it, though. All the things that have ever deeply possessed your soul have been but hints of it, tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. But if it should really become manifest, if there ever came an echo that did not die away but swelled into the sound itself, you would know it. Beyond all possibility of all doubt, you would say, here at last is the thing I was made for. We cannot tell each other about it. It is the secret signature of each soul, the incommunicable and unappeasable want, the thing we desired before we met our wives or made our friends or chose our work, and which we shall still desire on our deathbeds, when the mind no longer knows wife or friend or work. While we are, this is. If we lose this, we lose all. God will look to every soul like it's his first love, because he is its first love. Your place in heaven will seem to be made for you and you alone, because you were made for it. Made for it, stitch by stitch, as a glove is made for a hand. Beautiful. Beautiful. And I can't say I disagree with any of that. I just, I think what he described, that process and coming to know God itself, is heaven itself. And I won't dwell on that too much. I've talked about it before. You know, there's all sorts of rabbit holes we could go down in this conversation, but I'm going to finish this off here. We are nearly done with the quotes. The thing you long for summons you away from the self. Even the desire for the thing lives only if you abandon it. This is the ultimate law. The seed dies to live. The bread must be cast upon the waters. He that loses his soul will save it. But the life of the seed, the finding of the bread, the recovery of the soul, are as real as the preliminary sacrifice. Hence it is truly said of heaven, in heaven there is no ownership. For union exists only between distincts. And perhaps from this point of view, we catch a momentary glimpse of the meaning of all things. Pantheism is a creed not so much false as hopelessly behind the times. Once, before creation, it would have been true to say that everything was God. But God created. He created things to be other than himself, that, being distinct, they might learn to love him and achieve union instead of mere sameness. Thus, he also cast his bread upon the waters. Even within the creation, we might say that inanimate matter, which has no will, is one with God in a sense in which men are not. But it is not God's purpose that we should go back into that old identity, as perhaps some pagan mystics would have us do, but that we should go on to the maximum distinctness there to be reunited with him in a greater fashion. For in self-giving or sacrifice, if anywhere, we touch a rhythm not only of all creation, but of all being. The golden apple of selfhood thrown among the false gods became an apple of discord because they scrambled for it. They did not know the first rule of the holy game, which is that every player must by all means touch the ball and then immediately pass it on. To be found with it in your hands is a fault, to cling to it, death. But when it flies to and fro among the players too swift for an eye to follow, and the great master himself leads the revelry, giving himself eternally to his creatures in the generation and back to himself in the sacrifice of the word, then indeed the eternal dance makes heaven drowsy with harmony. And that's all I got for C.S. Lewis and his work, The Problem of Pain, from a Jungian point of view. I think I'll let it be for now. I invite you, if you made it this far, you know, go check out the episode Jung's Answer to Job. Go check out the episode The Image of God. Go check out my episodes with Miguel Connor talking about Gnosticism and cosmic terror. These will all, I assure you, if you go back through the episodes and look for the label, the titles that are referencing God, you will definitely find this material expounded upon. I wish I could have talked about it a little more as well. I try to keep these within a certain time frame, though. My throat is getting a little raw. And, you know, at a certain point, if you just keep going down all the rabbit holes, you start to lose the whole focus. So I know there's a lot of questions from this, but I think there was a lot of beautiful insight here. And, you know, when reading C.S. Lewis, you have a little bit of your work cut out for you, separating, like I said, some of the Christianization, the pigeonholes, but it's very much worth doing. He is a fantastic writer, a great Christian philosopher. He's someone that is worth, you know, contributing to your food for thought. So that's it for now. You know, I think from an alchemical point of view, there was a lot in there, and I hope you got something out of it. Don't forget to check out my link tree with all the action that you can follow me up on in the show description. This has been Black Hoodie Alchemy here on The Fringe FM. I'm Anthony Tyler. Get the fuck out of here. Smoke weed and God bless.
Fuck you, good morning. You can shove and break your foot on it. I leave the fake Suge Knights in your hood haunted. The masked devil, urban legend, I dash with a black rental and cast metal up through your glass window. I spit rhodium, the roller barrel eclipse all of your wordsmiths till I'm in the Smithsonian. I represent the podium, the smash it to pieces. Watch slivers scratch your eyes while they stab and then deepen. Standing and screaming, you ain't got no fan in the ceiling. Bars like my label, they ain't got no plans to release them. Lion's grit rule with an iron fist. Move on a silent tip while y'all get me confused for the rising wind. I'm bound to stop time. My rounds as loud as a Glock 9. An inclination, the sound of a drop dime. You down to rock rhymes, I'll have you concussed, outshined, and see your stars rotate counterclockwise. No amount of stop signs equal any shits given. You live gimmicks, a caricature, a crisp image. I carry the verses, condensed liquids, then bury the dirt like cement mixes to marry the earth and then kiss her. I even brought flowers, suited up and dropped out of life. Opened the box of elements and hopped down it. I kicked that moonshine addiction till you blue blind with sickness. Rap and death is a full-time commitment.
See, I smoke reefer, yes. Don't need your stress. Only your head. You hold secrets that nothing. I could see why you deceitful. See right through some people. So I do hustle deep. Do what I please. Who's just a scheme? You busters be bluffing. So I keep the heat discreet with me, feet on
check
concrete.
It. Yo, fuck these rappers and the rappers that they imitate. I'm doper than the lines that you chopping on your dinner plate. I've been a great. My soul never disintegrate. These stars fall faster than the Rari on the interstate. Zin, zin. Get about my lane and watch me innovate when I'm in the zone. Fucking up these beats has always been a trade. I've been the shit since a youngin' in the booster chair. And always keep a chick to keep me harder than Medusa stare. The truth is here, you ain't gotta look no further now. I wrote it down so this premeditated murder blow. My mind's spinning the studio, my kitchen, chefing up divine wisdom and flip it like dime pitching. It's the It's the kid that always keep a dime with them or a nickel and two pennies. These hoes, I got too many. These flows, I got too nice. I'm raising my bars up, smacking celebrities. The only way that we starstruck.
Smoke reefer, yes. Don't need your stress. Only your head. You hold secrets that nothing. I could see why you deceitful, see right through some people. So I do hustle deep, do what I please. Who's just a scheme, you busters be bluffing. So I keep the heat discreet with me when feet on concrete.